I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
No, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at Geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Tuesday, the 7th of January, 2020. On the podcast day, I have a long chat with Glenn Goodman, who is former ITV News business correspondent and now the author of The Crypto Trader. And Glenn talks about how he traded the Bitcoin breakout last night. It happened quite late, so he's up quite late, and explains what he did there. We also chat generally about blockchain, Bitcoin, and cryptocurrency news. Also on the podcast, I have two very important lists for you. The top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. These are companies people are adding to their watch list because they're doing more research or they're buying stock in the companies. Worth checking out, especially if one of those companies hasn't risen massively of late, because it means interest is building up for some reason. Also, the other list is a top five most liked RNSs. It's still quite quiet at the moment. Not a lot of news about. I think people are sort of warming up slowly into the new year, but I'll cover those top five in a bit. You can see top 10 versions of both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Want to keep up to date with all the companies in your portfolio? On the free Vox Markets app, you can create multiple watch lists and get instant news alerts about any company you follow. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Glenda Goodman, the crypto trader. And you just said, we just said a bit of a laugh there, a bit of a laugh and a joke.
Yeah, we like a laugh.
Who doesn't like a laugh, eh? Bit of banter. I said Glenda. He said, a lot of people call me Glenda. I said, just go with it. You know, put the makeup on, wear a dress, put a bonnet or something. You said, well, transgender maybe is the way to go. In this day and age, you know, if you are trying to market your wares, you've got to get all the attention possible.
Now, I need a USP, don't I? Yeah, exactly.
And I think a transgender crypto trader, you go vegan as well. If I were you, go vegan as well. And you're ticking a lot of boxes there, Glenn. You know what I'm saying?
Well, people have been calling me Glenda my whole life, so it's inevitable. My parents actually purposely called me Glenn, they say, because they wanted one-syllable names, because they hated the way that people with longer names get their names shortened all the time, right?
Yeah.
So they thought, oh, well, give him a one-syllable name. Nobody can mess around with that. And look what happened. It's a law of unintended consequences there.
Well, they could call you G, though. They could even shorter, just call you G.
Yeah,
G Goodman. So listen, quite an exciting night for you. I just say, you know, Glenn, can you come on? Because, you know, often we do podcasts and then we put them out and then all of a sudden Bitcoin price has moved. Now, for a long time, we've been looking at this level. It's been, you know, it's been sort of hovering around. I think last time we spoke, said, you know, we're sure it's forming quite a nice base here, maybe. Who knows?
Mm.
You never do know until the movement happens. So I contacted you and you said, last night, sorry, I've been up trading the breakout in Bitcoin. And it went through that sort of I was looking at 7,800. I mean, you may have gone in earlier than that, but I think a convincing breakthrough. 7,500 was quite convincing, but 7,800.
I got in about 7,500, cool. Or slightly above that, because that was the kind of if you're looking at it in a very tight way, that was the initial breakout. Yeah. But as you quite rightly say, most people were pinpointing 7,800 as the kind of key moment. But as far as I was concerned, the real breakout happened earlier than that, yeah, at about 7,500. So as soon as I saw the big volume kick in, and that's, you know, that's usually your signal, isn't it? If suddenly everybody starts buying, then, you know, well, that's the real breakout, isn't it? Despite whatever figure like 7,800 you may have had in your head beforehand, once the big volume kicks in and the price starts rising fast, that's your breakout right there.
Yeah, well, I've got, do you know what, a definite channel. So I've got channels coming down and, you know, support, just straight lines going across. And they converge, basically. Previous resistance at 7,800. It tried to get above this at 1, 2, 3, 4 times. And, of course, yeah, a downward channel as well. It's had breakouts above that channel, but it's not sustained it previously. But this from before last year, it's been trading in this range between 7,000 and 7,800, and it finally broke above that. So it may have a little pullback now. What's your thoughts now? Where does it go from here, Glenn?
Well, what I mean, I can tell you my strategy,
yeah,
and that is that I bought in last night, as I say, sort of late in the evening, and I
How late?
No, actually, the breakout itself happened at about 10 p.m.,
yeah,
10 or 11 p.m., and so I bought a big position at that point. But my strategy, which I'm doing more and more lately, actually, is this. I think I've talked about it before on the podcast. I will be happy to buy a big position, but then it's a bit too big to comfortably sleep on. I'm the kind of trader because you know,
get
the way
early,
I've managed to survive all these years, yeah, the way I've managed to survive as a trader for, you know, 20 odd years is by always hedging my bets and not risking too much on any one position. Yeah. But because I wanted to put a big position, because I believed that, you know, I could see that this was a channel just dying to break out, or a price dying to break out of a channel, rather. So I wanted to put on a big position, but I knew it was too big to actually sleep comfortably, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
So once it had risen by a few hundred points, then I sold half of my position and locked in a nice profit, which, as I've said before, I like to do that more and more now. I used to be very much a kind of strict trend follower who would say, right, you buy at the breakout point and then you hold it until you hold your position until the bitter end of the trend, enduring any massive corrections that may happen along the way. Now, that was all well and good when, say, I didn't have children and my life was a bit more kind of fancy free. But now that I'm trying to live a more sort of sensible, conservative lifestyle, it's inappropriate, I think, to allow yourself to go through such massive corrections and lose so much of your capital on the way up, as it were. So I try and kind of make my equity curve growth a bit smoother now by doing things like this, by buying a big position, and then after it's gone up a certain amount, then I'll sell half of it so that I've locked in a profit. So that smooths out my equity curve, even if the price now then retraces all the way back down to the breakout point, I'll still have a nice profit in the bank, if you see what I mean. But yeah, I'm still exposing myself to the potential for more profit because half of my position's open. So I think that's a nice kind of happy medium way to do it.
Yeah. No, I often find when I, you know, do some research on a stock, and I just almost convinced it's very cheap, you know, and even the, you know, I mean, the trend hasn't started yet, I will start scaling in, and then once it starts moving, you've got to, you know, go big early, because the initial move is the most aggressive, isn't it? And then
usually,
you make it. I mean, Bitcoin will have bigger moves, I assume. If we now stop that downtrend and we're going back into uptrend, there will be bigger moves. But I mean, on small cap stocks, you find that initial move, the fast, easy money happens then. And so, yeah go in big and then de-risk a little bit and then move out a little bit. Yeah, do you know what? Oddly, I mean, I was looking at the level anyway and I had alerts on. And when I went to bed, it had gone past, obviously, 7,500. But I got a bad toe. I've been running a lot, and I've got a really bad toe. I've had a blister.
Sorry, I shouldn't laugh.
Yeah. I had a blister formed on my right big toe. I'll give you the detail here. My right big toe, a blister has formed on a blister, has formed on a blister, and I haven't stopped running, so it's not really had time to heal. I've stopped running when I'm talking to you and stuff like that. What I mean, every morning I run. And so it was really hurting as I got up. and I saw my phone had an alert on about Bitcoin. It had gone past 7,800. So I did a chart and it said, well, it looks good for me. You know, it looks like it's breaking out. And that was sort of midnight-ish. And I went, I tried to go back to bed. I couldn't sleep, though. A bit of Savlon on the big toe, but didn't help.
Well, I wish your big toe better.
Yeah, well, I'm quite excited here because I do hold stock in Argo blockchain mining. They're a miner and they are one of the most efficient miners. They've got a decent margin. It's at 7,500. But, of course, sentiment is linked. And I've got, you know, the lower the price goes down, the more their margin gets squeezed. But also it's leveraged the Bitcoin price there. So,
Well, I mean, you asked me what I think is going to happen next. And whilst I'm not in the business of predictions, because I don't believe anybody can ever know the unknowable future.
Yes.
And with that disclaimer said, nonetheless, I have to say at this point in time...
Can I just say one thing? You're right there. Let me say one thing. Yeah. You are absolutely right not trying to predict anything. Do you know what I see over and over again on Twitter, especially because I'm on there and I'm quite active there, is that with stocks and with trading, people trying to predict. And I never try and do that, ever. Because you can... People say, oh, IMO, in my opinion... I say, yeah, well, when people say that, it's opinion. Doesn't mean it's based in fact whatsoever. And so I see this company producing a lot more of these or doing... And I think, well, how do you know that? It's not a... And people have a problem with trading or investing is that you have to know what is fact and what is opinion. Now, if someone's just, you know, investing in a stock, they have a biased opinion towards that stock doing well. They're in a long position, they're very biased. So you have to cut through all that and say, well, you don't know that. And I've seen quite experienced... You know, investors saying, well, if this is happening, this would be 20 pence by now. And I thought, you don't know that. You don't know that at all. So all
you can
do... The
problem is they're only taking into account a couple of factors. They're looking in a microcosm at, you know, they're not taking into consideration everything that could possibly affect that stock because they're not superhuman.
Do you know what? Genuinely, though, the microcosm they're acting is in their head. They're deluded and they're biased, confirmation bias, anything that happens, it's good news. If it's bad news, no, that's good news because that gets it out of the way. And so everything, so you've got to look at the fact, and even with charts, people doing these Fibonacci sort of predictions and all that, you don't know, you can't say that. All you can say is that it's tried to get above this level several times before, so that's resistance, so that's a real thing, you know?
I hate those kind of indicators that
those
people,
yeah,
as you say, Fibonacci is a perfect one because it's not grounded. Fibonacci numbers are grounded in science, but Fibonacci is used as a trading tool. There's no science behind it at all.
No.
And yet so many people rely on it, and they'll, as you say, they'll say on Twitter, you know, the Fib level
I don't care what the Fib levels are.
It's like, it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't tell you what's going to happen. And it's basically astrology, far as I'm concerned.
What I do is support and resistance, because if it's had issues getting above or below a certain level before and it does it, that's a change in the price direction. The momentum's going to pass, it'll put it forward. I also like, I mean, you probably don't know, I like moving averages as well, because that shows the average price, the average price over the last few days is changing. If those moving averages are changing in one way, that's the average price over 200 days or 50 days, it's moving in a certain direction, you know? It's giving you the direction of travel. Like, all these forecasts,
moving averages are a good tool, particularly for younger traders and newer traders. They can also be useful to more experienced traders, but I find myself using them less and less as I gain experience, because they're kind of almost like training wheels. Because moving averages are a lagging indicator, you know, they're based on past data, the average of prices. You look at the curves and they give you a very strong indication as to the general trend, where things are heading, which is great. But as I say, as I get older and I've stared at so many charts now that I find that I need them less and less, because I'm more and more able to just kind of identify the trends using my own eyes. But moving averages, nonetheless, they are, as I say, a very useful tool for beginners and earlier traders. But in addition to that, if you want to completely automate your trading, if you want to sort of, you know, encode it and set a little system going and make money, moving average crossover systems are still profitable in most asset classes, if not all asset classes. In fact, last time I checked, they were still working very well. People make money year after year by just setting a little system going where they buy and sell every time there's a certain moving average crossover that they've programmed in, and they just can make money indefinitely. definitely like that. I've often been tempted to go and just systematize in that way myself, and yet something still draws me to the kind of the hands-on approach, which is why I've stuck with it.
Well, do you know what? The only reason why something like Fibonacci will work is because people are trading it. I mean, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's not because it's a science, you know. And all you can work off with charts, I think, is probability. And I often look at that. And I look at, say, an RSI. I say, listen, last time it's gone in it's gone above the 60. It's moved significantly last three times. Or last time it's gone above the 200-day moving average. You can see it's been a sustained rise in the share price. So it helps you put the odds in your favour by looking at previous things that have happened, you know, previous scenarios, and saying, well, in fact, you know, five out of the last six times this happened, it's been very positive for the price. That's putting odds in your favour. You know, that's the only way we can do it, rather than just predicting in the future. You know, they get them. You know, we've spent in the world, they spent hundreds of billions trying to predict the weather because it's good for farms. It's billions of dollars account on the weather, and yet we still get it wrong from day to day. You know, it's not that accurate. So if you think some fella on Twitter can come up with, or a lady on Twitter can come up with a chart that'll predict the share price where it'll be in the next, you know, sort of 5-10 days, you're off your rocker completely. And if they could, that person would be a billionaire. It doesn't work like that. It's never that easy, is it?
So I actually did a calculation in the crypto trade in my book. I did a calculation to look at if any of these claims were actually true that these people make about how they know what's going to happen and they can make this percentage a month and that kind of thing, how long would it take them to become a billionaire? And what you find out is that virtually all those people who we're talking about, if they were telling the truth, they'd all be as rich as Warren Buffett within about sort of 10 years or so. Are we really going to see a massive rash of people who are as rich as Jeff Bezos in 10 years time? Because if all those people on crypto Twitter, as it were, who claim that they make this percentage a month and that percentage a year, if all of them are correct, then they're all going to be as rich as him very soon.
Exactly.
It's just not good. It's not feasible, is it? It's just they're all wrong.
Exactly. Let's look at what do you think? I mean, I've heard a lot of people say this Iran situation where Trump took out number two in Iran, which is it's really hot already. I just find now, if you know, in any other walk of life, if you'd done that, then you'd hide yourself, your identity. If you did a hit like that, you'd keep it quiet, you know. But because you're the president, you could say, yes, we took out Iran's number two, and you could almost promote it and say, boast about it, which is nuts. But and obviously, a lot of people say Bitcoin's rally is basically gone in line with gold, is the quality of gold as well, because of that disturbance.
I didn't buy that explanation. I can tell you right now. It was just a way again for people to kind of make themselves look big on Twitter, to write a few articles saying, look, we've managed to prove that Bitcoin is a safe haven. But that wasn't much of a move, to be honest. And what's more, if you look at the chart, it was perfectly in line with the previous ups and downs of the chart anyway. It was sort of, I mean, I hesitate to say predictable after everything we've said today, but you know, it was within the normal trading range what happened, the little rise in Bitcoin. What I'm saying is it was pretty much a coincidence that Bitcoin happened to go up a tiny bit around about the same time as the news came out about the Iranian general. Actually, it wasn't even around about the same time. You see, all the other, the real safe havens, like the accepted ones, like gold, it moved very quickly after the news. It went up very quickly straight after the news of the general, whereas Bitcoin's move didn't start until some hours later, and then people were starting to rationalize it by saying, oh, it was a delayed move, you know, because Bitcoin retail investors needed longer to assimilate the news into their trading plans. I mean, what a load of nonsense. I'm sorry, Bitcoin is not a world safe haven currency yet. I still have, you know, not faith exactly, but I'm still cautiously optimistic that Bitcoin will fulfill that role in the future and be a kind of a virtual gold, but I don't think we're there yet, and I don't think that move was caused by Iran.
You say the chart was playing out before that anyway. Interesting. So any news around on crypto, any positive news that you can say has helped? I saw something go on.
There's a go on. No, go on, you say yours first.
I saw something about Baidu. You know Baidu? Have you heard about Baidu?
Oh, yes.
They're forming their own crypto. Baidu is one of the biggest sort of stocks, or is it? Do they do, it's like an internet search engine in China, isn't it? Apparently,
It's kind of the Google of China. Yeah, because obviously they don't allow Google to do its normal thing in China because Google is very naughty. It allows all kinds of search results that where people are rude about the Chinese government, and we wouldn't want that, obviously.
So
Google is not sort of allowed to do its thing in China, and therefore Baidu is by far the biggest search engine in China. Now, it's launched its own cryptocurrency, which is called Superchain. Superchain, except it's spelt with an X at the beginning instead of an S to make it sound more crypto-ish, I guess. Super chain. It's fully compliant with China's policies, which is the all-important thing when you're in China, using a network of masternodes for efficiency. Its white paper claims it can process up to 10,000 transactions per second and support blockchain applications. Now, if it can do 10,000 transactions per second, then it blows Bitcoin out of the water for a start. But on the other hand, that doesn't mean everybody's going to suddenly start using Superchain instead of Bitcoin, because, of course, when they say it is fully compliant with China's policies, I think we all know what that means. It's basically shadow puppet run by the Chinese government, I would allege. Because if it has to be in line with China's policies, like so many major corporations in China, there is usually some kind of connection with the Chinese government because they sort of oversee everything. So I wouldn't expect the whole world to give up on Bitcoin and start using Superchain. But though this 10,000 transactions per second thing, that does draw some attention to Bitcoin's drawbacks. The fact that Bitcoin is slow and we have to use bolt-on solutions like the new Lightning Network in order to try and get Bitcoin up to the point where it can handle as many transactions per second as Visa or something like that. So as a future currency, at the moment, Bitcoin is somewhat lacking. But it must be said, Superchain is by far not the first to have 10,000 transactions per second. There are loads of newer cryptocurrencies that are not in league with the Chinese government and are able to handle that kind of workload. So I've been saying for some years that I think one of those newer cryptocurrencies could be the Bitcoin killer in the end, but we just don't know which one yet. That's the problem.
I'm still, like I said, at the moment I'm still questioning Bitcoin's store of value, whether it'll be the cryptocurrency. I mean, it is the at the moment, of course. Is it, what, 70%?
Yes.
The problem with Bitcoin, right, as I say, is the volatility that may slow down. But again, it's the liquidity. It's so easy to trade. If you own some, click of a button, you sell it. Not the same with gold. So you got gold rings. You can't just sell a gold with a click of a button. Really, it's not that easy. It's got to be ticked in somewhere, weighed, checked out, what sort of store of value, what sort of carat it is, all that stuff. And so that's why the stock of gold is quite well held.
Do you worry about Bitcoin that too much of it could be sold in one go, kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly. You don't know how much the original whales hold. You know, if it gets to a certain level now, they may say, "Do you know what? I'm checking out. I'm selling. I'm going to sell my billion in Bitcoin or whatever it is, or several billion." And because it's like I said, you don't know how much could be dumped in one.
But then gold gets affected by central banks in pretty much the same way, because so many central banks hold so much gold, and like when Gordon Brown decided to sell all our gold all at once 20 years ago. Central banks can dump a whole load on the market whenever they feel like it.
Yeah, but these days they don't, because I believe it's a store of... And I think if they do start dumping, someone else will start buying it, because they understand it's... if you look at gold, like I said, it's got a bigger history, obviously, than Bitcoin. And everyone's seen it's always risen, pretty much. We're at, a six-year high now. It's getting towards those highs. And it's done quite well over the last... So I think now people understand, I can't believe how soon it was that Gordon... I mean, he was up against he was in trouble there, but why would dump gold? You think, are you stupid?
When it was at its cheapest price, pretty much in a generation.
And he was in charge,
lowest possible price. Yeah. It was right in the valley between a massive boom in 1980s and then a massive boom, about 10 years ago now.
And so he was the chancellor.
He sold it right in the middle of those two points, kind of like...
Yeah, ironically, he was the chancellor. It's like, of all... wolf. You were the guy supposed to be in charge of the money, who knows about money, and
doesn't know about trading. You should have asked me, mate.
Yeah, yeah. But let's be honest. You could ask a housewife from Hull. You know, what do you do? Do you actually buy low, sell high, or sell low, buy high? What do you do? And even they would tell you. You know, you buy low, sell high. Everyone knows that phrase. Yeah. Surely, Gordon Brown, the Chancellor, is doing the complete wrong thing. Do you know what you should read, actually, Glenn? It's a good book. I've started reading it. It's only a quid on Kindle. It's called Bounce. Have you ever heard of that?
Oh, yeah, I've read it. Yeah, I've read it by Matthew Syed, isn't it?
Yeah, is it Matthew Syed? Yeah.
The journalist. I read it some years ago. Remind me... I remember really liking it. What's it about again? I've forgotten.
It's basically about... I agree with it to a certain level. Let me just see what I remember. Because is it Matthew Syed? Yeah. So basically, he was a very accomplished table tennis player, right?
Yeah, he was one of the best in the world.
Yeah,
wasn't
he? And the whole theory behind his thing is that talent doesn't really exist. It's practice.
It's the practice. He's doing the 10,000 hours.
It's basically
kind of thing.
Worth reading as well as Outliers by what's his name?
Outliers by by the famous Outliers, guy Malcolm Gladwell.
Yeah, basically, they're saying that he was lucky because for some reason he said some unexpected reason. Who knew why? But his parents bought him and his brother. He said a table tennis team, a fully fledged official table tennis. The mother and father never played table tennis in their life, but for some reason they bought one for the kids and they put it in the garage. He said, they didn't have a nice house, but they had the biggest garage they didn't use. So they put the table tennis in the garage. He was lucky to have that bought for him. Secondly, he was lucky to have an older brother who was really into it. So they played against each other. And thirdly, in school, their PE teacher was a very passionate PE teacher, but his main love was table tennis. And every other sport he did, basically, he wanted. And he also had a table tennis club called the Amiga Club. So he said, in our street, they had several over the years, because, you know, they had a PE teacher who was encouraging them. They had this table tennis club called Amiga Club. The PE teacher opened up, 24 hours a day. You could go there and play. He said they had, in their street, they had about sort of six of them that were national level table tennis players.
Yeah.
You know, some of them were international. He was, his brother was, international level. And he said, all about practice. He said, you know,
he talks about kind of a very specific kind of practice, doesn't he?
Yeah,
he says you could do sort of keepy uppies for years, and if you don't have a particular strategy, then your hours of practice are wasted, I think he said, didn't he?
Yeah, but I do disagree with him on a certain level. But he said basically, Malcolm Gladwell also said, to become an expert in any field, you have to do 10,000 hours. What that equates to is pretty much 3 hours per day, every year for 10 years, you know, and most people say 10 years is a thing, but Dad will put you down to that specific sort of thing. So I do agree with that. I think you can't replicate practice or experience, you know. Like you said, you just said then, right, about looking at charts, and I agree with you. I look at this chart now, and I think the bounce in Bitcoin is going to come back a little bit, but it's gone into a different level here, but it'll come back a little bit more. People will doubt whether there's an uptrend, but I think it will continue.
I think one important thing I haven't said so far, actually, is that so far, and obviously this might even be an obsolete comment by the time the podcast is released, but I'm going to say it anyway. So far, I'm impressed by this breakout of Bitcoin, because you know how very often when there's a breakout, well, in anything, in stocks, whatever, but particularly in Bitcoin, when you get a big breakout and the price shoots up, more often than not, in fact, much more often than not, it retraces all the way back down pretty much straight away. It has what you call a retest all the way back down to the breakout level and then bounces back up again. Now, that's the normal thing. But what's happened here is that it went all the way up. And this is why I stayed up half the night, because I was waiting for that retest. Mm. Never really happened. Yeah, okay, the price came down from $8,000 to about $7,800, but it didn't get anywhere near to the $7,550 or $7,600 where the initial breakout happened. And as we speak, that's still the case. It seems a very good sign to me. It's a sign of strength, as traders call it. So, you know, fingers crossed on this one. I'm cautiously optimistic, which is about as optimistic as I ever get. Cautiously.
Yeah, but you know what? It's like when you look at, I look at charts every day, probably for several hours every day, and I've done it for, you know, over a decade. And you do see patterns. And this pattern right now, like I said, this extended base we've had since before December, where it's tried to get above that level and it's broken out. We haven't had that long sort of range Well,
no, we
I can't see it. I can't see it in the last year, pretty much.
Yeah.
That's why it helps to draw lines to sort of confirm what you're looking at. But you can sort of see the, and that was, that's very much the sort of the content of this book, saying the chess grandmasters, when they put against Deep Blue, the computer generated first time, Garry Kasparov. Even though he can think 3 moves per second, this computer could think 100 moves per second, but Garry Kasparov beat it, because he said there are certain scenarios that the chess game couldn't see that he could, and he got it in his head through experience. He said, okay, going from here, the probability of me getting to there is easier, and all that stuff. And so it's just seeing patterns. And he said, it's like this with, from hockey players or football players, they see patterns. But this is where his argument falls down. But I agree with him up to that level. Practice, you can't beat practice and experience. You need to get that. And that's why I always argue about people come into investing or come into trading and believe they can make money day one, year two, and you can't. It's a trade. It takes a long time to get where you want to get. It takes a lot of losses. And if you limit those losses, you can carry on in the game and you can get better and better. This is where I disagree with Matthew Syed. And that's this. How come then, in every, say in international side of any sport, they're all done pretty much the same practice, haven't they? They've all put the same hours in, but there's always some people better than others, So talent does have an edge, So you can.
It does. And in fact, that's been proven because Matthew's book was written 10 years ago. Since then, there's been further research done into the area, and we now know, fairly conclusively, that you're absolutely right. That, there are a lot of people doing 10,000 hours, and yet they're not all superstars. Many of them are far from it.
Exactly.
Now, Matthew might argue they weren't doing targeted enough, strategic enough type of practice. Yeah. Perhaps that's the case for some of them, but a lot of them have got world-class trainers and so on, and the fact is that it appears from the studies that I've read anyway that talent does still have a large part to play, yeah.
Yeah. No, exactly. I mean, I've always said this. I remember arguing, right? We had this course once. I used to have a radio station. We used to get people come in sometimes. We had days away. We had coaching days. And, these coaches would pretty much encourage everyone to say you can do as well as anyone else. And I remember once having an argument about, at the time it was like Tim Henman was our guy in tennis against Andrew Agassi, who was the world champion. I said, well, hang on a sec. They both practice the same. Andre Agassi will smash Henman every time out of the court. So how do
Andrew Agassi?
Yeah, Andre Agassi. Yeah. And I said,
I couldn't let that one pass.
How do you square that one up? I said, no. That's because he's had better coaches. No, I said, it's not that. I said, don't get me wrong. Experience and putting the hours in, you can't beat that. But also, you can edge it with that bit of talent as well. Just edge it. Same with when you've got a level player. Why is Ronaldo paid like 10 times more than someone else in his team? Because he's a game winner. He's amazing, a talent. So
exactly. He probably doesn't work any harder than a lot of his teammates, but he just has that extra edge. Exactly. Well, I'm conscious that you're going to want to finish, so I want to give you that final story. It's a kind of and finally, really, in the world of Bitcoin, if you will. The Dickening. Have you heard of this?
Yes. I haven't heard of it. I think I know what it is.
It's John McAfee, the controversial international playboy who made all his money from his McAfee antivirus software, which I'm sure everybody's come across at some point or another in the past. And he sold his company for hundreds of millions of dollars and made an enormous fortune, and then became a Bitcoin cheerleader. He's exactly the kind of person you're complaining about, because he's obviously bought a ton of Bitcoin some years ago and now just says nothing but positive things about it the whole time and gets a lot of publicity for it. Now, he famously promised to eat his penis if Bitcoin isn't worth $1 million by the end of 2020. He said, and he promised that he was going to definitely eat his penis. So a website has been set up called dickening.com. That's what they call the event where he's going to eat his penis. But now, shockingly, just as everybody was getting all excited for the live televising of the eating, he's suddenly saying, oh, it was just a joke. I didn't mean it. He's written a tweet saying, eat my dick in 12 months. It was a ruse to onboard new users to Bitcoin. It worked. What a smug git. I mean, honestly.
And not only that, I think he could have played it out longer. He could have dragged it out a bit longer, couldn't he? You know, yeah. You could have got up the day before and said, I was only kidding.
Somebody's written to him, yeah, your word is your bond, John. And he replies, John says, wake the F up. What idiot thinks anyone is going to eat their own dick ever? Especially on
fair
TV.
Play. Fair play. You know, if anyone is going to hold him to that, they're as stupid as he is for saying it. I mean, he was a joke, and no one actually believes that, do they? I mean, the thing is, it's one of these things, I don't know if you've seen that. If you're going to make a prediction, make a wild prediction, you know? Because if if it comes true, you're a genius. If it doesn't come true, pretty much no one really holds you up to it. It's like these guys like Noral Rabini and all that stuff, you know? Oh, he's the guy that predicted, you know, I think we said about this before. He's the guy that predicted the last financial crash. Do you know what? He's called for a crash every year, pretty much. And then sooner or later, it's going to happen. And then but every time he calls for a crash, he calls for an almighty crash. So when it doesn't happen, people ignore him. When it does happen, say, this is the guy. He called it. So if you're going to make a prediction, make it far. I saw another one recently on Twitter, and someone said he's going to eat his dog's doings or something like that. If Bitcoin wasn't zero or something by 2020, and obviously it wasn't a zero. And someone said, but yeah, if you want to make a name for yourself, you've got to make wild predictions. And if they come true, you're proclaimed a genius. If they don't come true, you're just one of a million voices making silly predictions. That's all, you know.
I suppose. And the sad thing about it is that I bet people will still listen to his predictions in the future, despite him going back on that. All it does is just make him more famous, and then more people will listen to him. It's astonishing. As we see with Donald Trump, you can say all kinds of things, and it doesn't necessarily harm your popularity.
Exactly. You can't fail. If you want to be popular, just make a ridiculous... And let's be honest, he's in charge of software security. What makes him the kingpin of cryptocurrency? But, you know, because he's left that company wild. He went on a wild for years, didn't he, running away and trying to avoid tax and all that. So he's a bit of an outlandish guy.
Spent most of his fortune usual.
And like you say, everyone knows when there was the ICOs were going mad a couple of years back, you know, he was being paid by any and every ICO. He'd just take the money and say, yeah, this is the next big ICO. This is the next big cryptocurrency. And he'd take the money, then you wouldn't hear from talk about it again. So I don't see why people trust his word. It's like, you know, everyone should know that.
But he was being paid $100,000 to just do single tweets advertising particular cryptocurrencies.
Exactly. And I guarantee he wasn't taking that money in that cryptocurrency. He was taking it in cash. There was no way he was going to take it in a cryptocurrency he was promoting that he knew was rubbish. Marvellous. Glenn, thanks for that, fella. And
no problem.
It'll be interesting to see where Bitcoin is. You know, as we get close towards the halving, I don't think it's priced in. I think as... it gets to, I mean, as I say, what you need is a rising price of Bitcoin. That's what gets people excited. Then everything you will find when it starts getting towards mainstream TV.
I'm already getting excited. How different are you to the you that I spoke to last week when you were like, oh, I'm not sure about this whole Bitcoin thing. And it's like, and I think I said to you last week, didn't I? Maybe it's just the kind of the grinding downwards that had kind of got you down.
Because
it had gone on 6 months.
Well, also why I'm excited is because I know the company I'm invested in can make good, you know, it's generating good cash at these levels anyway. So if it goes up, and I said, I don't want it to go up too much because the mining becomes harder than anyway, but I want it to be, I want the volatility to stop a little bit, stop the downtrend. As long as the downtrend stops, they're going to make money. And also, I don't want to be too bullish because it gets more competition to mine. But I'm excited that now, if it carries on this level, they're adding more machines. They're adding thousands of machines every month. So, they'll be, I think, they're at 7,000 mining machines now. They're at 17,000 they're hoping to be at. They're just waiting for delivery I think, the end of Q1 next year. So if it stays at this level, I think it's a cheap stock. It's like, they're only valued at 20 million market cap. And they generated 9 million in cash in the first half of last year. And that was when they had less than 5,000 machines. I think it's a good sort of business if they're in there.
I'm looking at their chart at the moment, if I can give you my chart view. I mean, ARB, you know, as you can ARB. See, what they did, they had a kind of classic head and shoulders pattern, which has failed, which is a really good sign. So, you know, for anybody who understands about patterns and that kind of thing, about June last year, they had about a 6-month pattern, which would be very bearish, and it broke down. So back in November, it looked like, you know, oh dear, it's going into a bear market. But then it abruptly sort of turned around in late December, which is a very good sign. The good thing about these patterns, you know, like the most common ones, head and shoulders is like kind of triangles and horizontal lines. Those are, apart from a couple others, those are pretty much the only patterns I trust. Yeah. Most of the stuff, as we've said, fib levels, all kinds of other indicators. There's a lot of nonsense in the charting world, but some stuff is actually backed up by numerous studies, which is why I talk about it in my book, Head and Shoulders, for example. It looks silly, but it's backed up by numerous studies that you can really trade off particular patterns like that one. And when you have a failure of a pattern, it can be just as meaningful as when the pattern succeeds. Yeah, yeah. The Head and Shoulders having failed on Argo blockchain is actually a really good sign. It shows
that I liked as well.
The chart has attempted, the price has attempted to plummet and failed because a whole load of new buyers came in and pushed it up. And that kind of, that gives extra kind of strength to the price.
Do you know what I like as well, though? So I've been buying when it's been around about sort of 5.5, 6 pence. And what I liked is that if you look back at like when they did their first trading update, when they started, their business was started as letting anyone mine via the cloud, and they realized there's too much to set that up and too much cost, so they started mining on their own book, and that they cancelled the private investors mining via them. And they did their first sort of, you know, update back in May last year, and you see where it gapped up there massively on that little news, because that's working. And so it's really tested that level there, like that big gap up there, really tested that. And I like it bounced off it nicely. And now we're back above 200-day moving average. So I think now, as the more machines come online, they've got like a nice margin there. They got a 75% mining margin, which is a nice margin at the current level. So I like that. I just think it's quite a sustainable business if they're well, who knows, a bit gone. I don't know how sustainable it is.
Who knows?
I know for the...
It's a punt, isn't it?
Yeah.
If
Bitcoin stays around this level in this trading range, they're fine. They'll do well. You know, it's fine.
Yeah.
So it's just the uncertainty of where the bottom in Bitcoin was that was pushing had pressure on the share price of Argo blockchain. So now we know, hopefully, we've hit the bottom here, a temporary bottom, which obviously stabilizes. Anyway, marvelous stuff. Thanks, Zach.
Good stuff.
And we'll speak to you next week.
All right.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Open Orphan. That's ORPH. Hoping to get Cal on the podcast very soon, because lots going on. I know there's a takeover happening, so sometimes they have to go very quiet with that. But I'm expecting more news, hopefully, from them once that's over with. But at four, Ixico PLC. Chatted with Alan Green on the podcast. I like the tech, but like I said yesterday, it's quite highly valued at the moment, but maybe there's a reason for that. Who knows? At three, Galliford Try. That's GFRD. Down 6.6% to 152.2 pence. At two, it's Myriad Advertising. Again, Alan Green talked about that yesterday in the podcast. They're in a bit like Bidstack, but in TV and movies and video, you know, that kind of stuff, but with advertising there placed in there, ad placement. And number one most followed company is a similar group. It's the old YOLO, I suppose. Change the name. YOLO, YOLO Leisure and Technology. Okay, top five most liked RNSs came from. At five, Open Orphan, result of general meeting. At four, Fast Forward Innovations, board appointment. At three, Premier Oil, proposed UK North Sea acquisition. At two, STX Energy, reserves upgraded at South Dusuk. And number one most liked RNS is Rockrose Energy Year End Trading Update. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.